Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. It's me on my own again for the last week. Next week we are back as a twosome. Not me and Jermaine, unfortunately, but me and Tom. So you might have heard in the last couple of weeks, we talked about our link up with the boys at Fast Running. So Robbie Britton, Tom Cragg is going to join me on a rolling basis. Tom's going to start off next week and we're going to start having various features and focuses we're going to talk about together. So next month we're going to be dealing with I guess it's a difficult topic to give one title to, but I guess inclusion and diversity. So we're going to talk about various issues, from whether running is too white and middle class, whether we could be doing more as a sport to attract different ethnic groups into the big loving warm embrace of running, but also we're talking about women. Obviously, with the fallout with the Mary Kane issue over in America and the issues that arisen from the way that she was treated, we're going to talk a bit about that. So, lots of different issues to discuss. We're going to talk about them over 4 weeks, and there's various ways for you to get involved and join in the debate. So that'd be quite interesting. We'll outline that all next week. On this week, obviously, we're still finishing off our focus on health. So we've looked at oral health a couple of weeks ago with Ian Needleman. We've looked at longevity and veteran runners with Tommy Hughes. We're going to look at this one about two things. First being genetics. So we're going to talk to Colin Moran. So Colin is an associate professor at the University of Stirling, and his focus primarily is epigenetics and genetics. So we could talk about that and how they affect performance. But also we're going to talk about public health. So he is involved with the project Daily Miles and lots of research into the benefits of the Daily Miles. So if you haven't heard of that, it's an initiative that started over in Stirling, actually, in the school there. And it's about getting kids out to run once a day in an effort to improve their health, but also their energy levels and their productivity at school. So we're going to talk to him about that and the research that comes out of that, and how, I guess, as runners, we can, I don't know, impact and make a change to public health and what the current debates are. So we're going to talk a bit about that. Enjoy that. If you can share the show, please do, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all those sorts of things. At Let's Get Running is our handle. Is it handle? Is that an old school way of talking about it? I don't really know. Anyway, share the show. Please rate and review. We really love reviews. And subscribe. Get the share every week. Obviously, with this week's show, it's supposed to be out on Wednesday. That's my fault. If you're subscribed, it doesn't matter. You haven't got to go back and pick it up. It will be in your inbox every time we publish a show. So, yeah, do all those things. And here we are. We're going to talk to Colin now. So, on today's show, we are speaking to Colin Moran. How are you doing, Colin?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
And have I pronounced Moran right? Moran, have I got the wrong pronunciation there already?
No, that's fine. Moran is what I go by mostly. So.
Perfect. And you're associate professor at University of Stirling in the Faculty of Health Sciences and Sport.
Yeah, so I've been here for I think about 8 years now, and it's a great place to look into aspects of sport or exercise. There's a lot of really good people here.
Fantastic. And also you're linked to the Daily Mile.
Yeah, in a slightly unusual way. So I now do a lot of research on it, but when I first got interested in it, I got interested because it was actually my primary school that had started. I also grew up in Stirling.
Okay.
My dad was a lecturer at the university a long time before me as well.
Great. And can you give us some background on the Daily Mile? What's it all about, for those who haven't heard about it?
So the Daily Mile is this idea which has spread rapidly through Scotland, the UK and abroad, that to help improve the fitness of kids, they should be getting out and doing a bit of running every day in schools. So the idea is to keep it simple. So it's meant to be 15 minutes from desk to desk. There's no changing clothes, no changing shoes. There's no equipment required. The teacher has some control over when it happens. So she might think that the class is flagging a bit just now. Let's go and do our Daily Mile. So the kids, they know what's happening. They all get up, out the door they go, and they run laps of something, typically a football pitch or playground, for 15 minutes.
Right.
And if they run the whole time, that will be about a mile. So hence the name, a daily mile. But in actual fact, because they're doing laps, if they don't want to run, some of them might walk, or they might not be so fit, or and they won't actually make a mile, but they'll all still be in that same area when they finish. So
Yeah.
it's convenient then for the teacher to bring them back in together.
Excellent. And how's it taken off? So it's started there in Stirling in your children's primary school, and what has it been picked up by different agencies and different schools and grown?
So I got involved in, I think it was 2015. It'd been going for about 3 years at that stage. I was actually on my way to a conference, a genetics conference, looking at the genetics of sporting performance in Greece. And I was at the airport on my own, looking on my phone at the news, and I saw some headline. I think it said, "Children run for their lives." And I recognised the picture underneath it because it was my school. So I read about it. And by the end of that day, myself and a colleague who also had been a former pupil there, I emailed in and said to the head teacher, we now do physiology related stuff at the university nearby. We've seen what you're doing. We think it's really exciting. Could we come and talk to you about doing some research?" And at that stage, the head teacher was really keen, and that's how all of the research started. But at that stage, it was spreading locally. Elaine Wiley, the head teacher, had given talks to other teachers. And it was going a reasonable distance. It was easy to do, and it was popular. But that first week of when the research actually happened, which was probably about 5 or 6 months later, that first week, Elaine Wiley won Head Teacher of the Year on the Pride of Britain Awards.
Wow.
And the next day, the BBC phoned me and said, "We hear there's a research project going on this. Could we talk to you about it?" And that really, that sort of media coverage really boosted it. And then over the next lot of months, Elaine retired from teaching, but she began working with a new charity called the Daily Mile Foundation, who were formed to promote the Daily Mile. And they have an excellent website. They're supported by INEOS.
Yeah.
And the Daily Mile, I mean, the website is now in multiple languages. The Daily Mile itself is in over 10,000 schools in 71 countries. So, it's been a combination of things that have made it grow, but it's really taken off around the world now.
Wow. Well, one sort of introducing a quick negative. I was towards it, but maybe 3 years ago, I retweeted some stuff about the Daily Mail, and I was attacked on Twitter by people who were saying you should never back anything by INEOS. These guys are fracking, blah 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 blah. And you haven't had any of that kind of like any one attacking you for being involved with a company that's a
No, I mean
charity.
we. No, I mean we've actually been quite careful. So we are not in any way supported by INEOS. So not because we don't think they should be involved, just because we want to try and make a distinction that we're doing independent research. I mean,
Yeah.
the Daily Mile is a good thing, and the research that we've done has shown that it is good for kids.
Yeah.
We are very keen to support it and promote it in as far as we can.
Yeah. And let's talk about the research and that you guys are wanting to. What were you aiming to look at and get out of the project?
So we were quite lucky when we had our first meeting with Elaine, the head teacher. She had already done a little questionnaire survey with pupils and parents and teachers. And that meant that in that initial conversation, she was able to say to us, "There are here's a list of anecdotally reported benefits about how the Daily Mile has improved things." And this included things like the kids are fitter, they're less fat, they're more physically active, they're more willing to run round to a friend's house instead of asking for a lift. They sleep better, they behave better. The list went on and on. So what we did was, after that meeting, we tried to put together a team of people who could look at some of these benefits. In our initial piece of research, we focused on physical health benefits. So we focused on fitness of the kids, which we measured using a bleep test, which I imagine most of your listeners have done, or at least are familiar with.
Yep.
It's it, Don't know what your listeners are like, but it's interesting. You talk to a group of adults, they're usually groans in the room. When you talk to a group of kids, they love doing the bleep test. It's quite a different reaction that you get. So we did the bleep test with the kids. We measured fatness or adiposity, and we did it using something called skinfold. So if you know anything about obesity or BMI, is the common measurement of somebody's body composition. But actually, BMI isn't a wonderful measurement because it can't tell the difference between muscle and fat. It's just weight divided by height squared is how you arrive at that number. Mm-hmm. So we avoided doing that, and we went for skinfold, which allowed us to get a direct measure of fatness. And then we also put small devices, basically little belts, on the kids that measured their physical activity and the amount of sedentary time they had, so the amount of time they had sitting around. Those are called accelerometers, and they're actually inside all of our smartphones, although we obviously had research standard ones. So we measured that in two local primary schools. We measured those things, in two local primary schools before and after one of the schools introduced the Daily Mile, and that allowed us to see how, because obviously the kids are growing, so all those things are changing all the time. But that allowed us to have one school where we were just measuring the normal change and one school where we were measuring the change when you also add the Daily Mile. Right. And what we found was that the kids did get fitter. They were a little bit less fat. They had a better body composition. They were more physically active and they were less sedentary. So it was doing all the things that it was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, excellent. And It's funny because when I look back at when we were at school, like you weren't really allowed to run. Like I think the furthest you could run was 600 meters in a PE lesson and stuff. It's strange that now are they coming round to, and obviously I guess when we were in that period in the 80s, women weren't allowed at the Olympics to run 10,000 meters. So things are changing with time. But it's good that now that the a mile is in, and a daily mile is something that it shows to have this much benefits, and schools and government bodies it looks at are taking that step.
Yeah, so I don't remember the restriction. I was also at school in the 80s. I don't remember the restriction on distance, but maybe that was just because none of us could actually achieve 600 meters. I don't know. Excuse me. But there's a number of reasons, I think, why the Daily Mile has taken off. Part of it's been the media coverage that it's had, absolutely. Mm. Part of it is its simplicity. Yeah. It doesn't need any equipment. It doesn't need any skill. All the kids can run or walk. If you try to get them skipping, you might find that some of the younger kids can't do it. If you try and get them playing a sport, well, it requires teaching skills then as well. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
But of course, from a council's point of view, or from a school finance point of view, there's no cost to it, which also allows it to spread. It can spread into low and high socioeconomic areas equally well. There's nothing that you need financially to be able to do the Daily Mile, which I think is a big plus for it, but it's a big part of its success that there's no initial investment. You just need a desire to bring it into your school, and then you can have a go at doing it. And most of the time, it sticks. Now,
what has been
part
the,
of the reason that?
Carry on, sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I was just going to say, I think part of the reason that it sticks in schools, and I think this is a very important part of it, is because it's fun for the kids.
Yeah.
Now I'm talking anecdotally. Now this is not part of the research that we've done, but the stories that we hear are, and certainly our own experience in my kids' primary school was that it was the parents really pushing for it initially that got it in, and there was some resistance once it was in because in the first couple of weeks kids were coming home quite muddy and they tried wearing different shoes and things, and it didn't go too smoothly. And then fairly quickly that all ironed out.
Yeah.
And largely that seemed to be because the kids liked doing it. The kids were happy. They were telling their parents they were enjoying it. And it's still going a couple of years later after it was first introduced. So I think that fun element is really important.
Yeah. And has it been, let's say, adopted by councils as requirement in schools? Or again, is it just something that is almost like a grassroots movement that people, schools individually will pick up where they want to, and has there been any official recognition, let's say, of the project?
So it's both. It's absolutely a grassroots movement that is spreading in through people seeing it in other schools happening or seeing stuff online about, and oh, we could do that. But it's also coming from the councils. And for instance, in Scotland, and I think it's true in Wales as well, the governments both put out statements of 2 or 3 years ago now, saying that they encourage all schools to do the Daily Mile.
Yeah.
In England, it's part of the UK obesity strategy. So it's definitely getting top level recognition, but it's also spreading in a grassroots fashion.
Great. And one thing I've to ask a little bit earlier is, with your research, this actually probably isn't something you covered in what you're doing, is there a benefit to doing it during the day? Is there a benefit to do it whenever the teacher feels able to, or as opposed to perhaps at the beginning of a day or an end of a day? Has there been any look into that?
So, you've raised a really important point there.
Yeah.
We would advise people not to tack it on to break or lunch, to try and use it to break up sedentary time during lessons. So what you typically find is, in a lot of schools, at least in this area, a lot of schools will have the lunch hour at slightly different times for the older and younger kids.
Mm.
And that can mean that one group of kids have quite a long afternoon because they've gone for an early lunch. And usually the teachers of those classes will usually do the Daily Mile in the afternoon.
Right.
Whereas others might do it in the morning because they've got a slightly longer morning. So you use it to try and break up time like that.
Mm.
So the other important thing about doing it during the day, I think, comes from our second piece of research. So when we were working or just finishing up working on our first study about the health benefits, the BBC got in touch with us and they said, we see you're involved in this Daily Mile research project. We're interested in doing something which essentially was a citizen science project called Terrific Scientific.
Mm.
Would you be interested in putting something in for that program and seeing if we can agree on something that would work for the BBC as well as us? So ultimately we did. And what we did was we created a research project which the BBC supported us to create lesson plans and all sorts of really cool stuff.
Mm.
So that teachers and kids could collect the data themselves and send it back to us. But it was also answering a question that nobody knew the answer to. So the question that we decided to focus on was, what are the immediate benefits of taking short classroom physical activity breaks?
Mm.
And this time, rather than looking at health, we looked at what's called cognition. So something related to learning of the kids. And ultimately, we had over 10,000 kids, can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, doing a variety of tests for us. Looking, so little things like reaction time tests, stopping themselves, pressing an arrow when it changed color, remembering words, our sentences making sense, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which they did online on a website for us. But ultimately what we found was that doing a Daily Mile-like activity was better for kids' cognition than doing nothing. So it was a control activity. But what we also found that we thought was really interesting was we had a third condition where the kids exercised to near exhaustion. So the Daily Mile is self-selected. It's a pace that they're comfortable going at, which means it's relatively intermediate. But we also had a more extreme intervention where kids were doing a bleep test. And we measured their cognition before and after doing this bleep test. But what we found in that was that it wasn't as good as doing the Daily Mile, but it was no worse than the control activity. So you might automatically think that if kids exercise to exhaustion when they come back in, they won't be able to learn as well. They won't be concentrating. But actually, if the option is have them sitting around doing nothing, then letting them exercise to exhaustion is just fine.
Yeah.
But best of all, to get them to exercise somewhere in between.
Okay, fantastic. So I guess in terms of thinking about implications for adults listening to this podcast, I guess we can probably take the same, logically, they take the same conclusions there to our own lives, and that work, some kind of exercise during the day, will improve our ability to perform in the tasks we're doing at work.
Yeah, so there's growing evidence on this kind of stuff. Now, workplace physical activity is not my area of expertise. Some of my colleagues do that, but absolutely, broadly, the same things are true. It not just our ability to think and learn and therefore perform in our work tasks, not just the obvious stuff like our physical health, but there are lots of other benefits to doing physical activity. And one of the ones that's getting a lot of interest now is the improvements in mental health when people are doing physical activity and regularly doing physical activity. But there's all sorts of other stuff about, particularly with older adults, of reduced risks of hip fractures or reduced risks of dementia as people age. There's a reduced risk of dying, full stop, of all-cause mortality, but that's largely associated with the health benefits. Reduced risk of certain types of cancer, reduced risk of diabetes. I mean, physical activity is a brilliant free treatment for many of the problems that we have in society at the moment, and we need to encourage more people to do it.
And this is a difficult question, but do you think our encouragement is working? So I'm always reading stuff about, because my work is I organize run clubs in companies, so I'm consistently reading things about how the population don't actually get the amount of recommended physical activity in each week. And do you think we're doing a good job at encouraging people to do it, and this recommended levels, is that the right way to encourage people, or the right policy to get people moving?
I'm going to hedge my bets here. Yes and no. So I think the recommended levels are important as a target. I think our communication of them needs to improve, and it needs to be much more nuanced. Mm. Now, of course, there are problems with that, because when you nuance a message, you know, instead of having one version, you've now got 10 versions of it, and it's less clear. It doesn't get around so well. Mm. There's one I heard recently. So you're probably aware that as an academic field, we have recently revamped the physical activity guidelines. So we've had a couple of conferences recently in the last few years about what should go in the new guidelines and how should we be communicating it. So simple messages that can mean different things to different people, I think, are important. So one of my favorite ones is sit less, move more. Yeah. And actually a development of that, given the conversation we're having a second ago, is sit less, move more, feel good. So in developing those messages, I think it's important to try to understand the motivation of the people, or rather what will motivate the people that you are trying to communicate to. Mm. Quite often people in the room are people who do lots of sport, physical activity, and I'm sure you are the same, and I certainly am motivated by moving more to get fitter. But actually that probably isn't the case for people who aren't moving enough. Some of them it will be, of course, but many of them it would be about the fact that when you join a walking group, you make lots of new friends and it's fun, and you feel good about yourself. Or for some people, it might be that they feel a bit sharper during the day when they're doing their work. Yeah, and so the message has to become a bit more nuanced in that respect about what do individual or a number of sort of broad groups of people actually want. What will motivate them to do this thing that we know is good for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking, for some reason, then the slogan there got me thinking about the fact that we're obviously doing a general election here in the UK, and there seems to be nothing that Boris Johnson can do wrong, but he's got his slogan, "Get Brexit Done," and it seems to be cutting through to according to polls, to this huge sway of the people, which I find crazy. But anyway, it's interesting.
That's. You need a marketing expert on the line, I think, to talk about that. But I agree. I think that, you know, there is stuff around the simplicity of a message, whether it makes sense or not. If it's simple, people remember it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You think of all, even back in the world of sport, the slogans for the big companies, just do it from Nike. Everybody knows that,
Yeah.
because it's a nice, simple slogan,
Yeah.
and it cuts through.
Yeah.
So I think there are lots of parallels there, absolutely.
And then I'm going to think about kind of your specialism. So you look a lot at genetics and it's epigenetics, sorry. It's
That's
kind of,
right, yeah.
that's your specialism. So obviously that we all know kind of that has the way people respond and the way people like stick to and are affected by exercise depends a lot upon those fields, I guess. Can you give us a brief introduction to or what is epigenetics for those who don't know?
Oh, okay, so I'm actually going to start with genetics because it's a bit easier to do that one.
Yeah.
So you said something there. You talked about responders and non-responders to exercise. And most people have probably heard that term, but they tend to think of these as being two very separate groups. Actually, it's just a continuum. So everybody, it's degrees of responsiveness, and everybody falls on that continuum somewhere. But what people often don't appreciate actually is how big a role genetics plays in that. They might admit that it plays some sort of role. But actually, studies from the 80s and 90s and 2000s have shown, so we can do large studies without actually needing any DNA from people by looking at family relationships. So, if you've got any brothers or sisters, you will share, well, with your mum and dad, you will share half your DNA. You get half of it from each of them. And you will, if you've got any brothers and sisters, you will also share half your DNA with them. Grandchildren share a quarter of their DNA with their grandparents. And so you can work out all these relationships. If you also can compare how similar they are in something related to sport. So that might be as simple as, do they do sport or not? Or do they do it? What level do they do sport at? Did they play for local sports teams, or were they semi-professional? Were they ever fully professional? Or it could be VO2 max tests, or it could be endurance performance, a whole host of things. You compare that with the known relationship between family members, and you can show, and there's a number of studies that have done this now, that for most things, roughly 50% of the differences between us are down to our genetics. So it's a huge chunk. And if you think about that, that means that genetics is at least as important to sports performance as everything else put together. So all that stuff about diet and training and opportunity, how close is the velodrome if you want to be a cyclist and all that sort of stuff. Now, I'm always slightly careful here because I am a geneticist by training, but I lecture to sport and exercise scientists. I'm not trying to say that sport and exercise science or nutrition doesn't matter. You've got to do both. If you want to be a world beater, you've got to have the right genetics, and you've got to do the training and have the right diet and all that other stuff. Having the right genetics on its own won't do it for you. You might be the people with the best genetics in the world might, in fact, spend most of their time playing video games and never set foot on a running track. You do have to do both to see it. So genetics is enormously important. And our best estimates, there are going to be lots of genes involved. It's not a gene for sport. There are probably going to be about 1,000 genes involved, each with a small effect. So what that means is that most of us have got 500 making us, excuse me, faster and 500 making us slower. So we end up average. And then a few people sort of stretch away from that. And the elite athletes are the extremes, but even they don't have perfect genetics. They've just got better or good genetics for their chosen sport, and they're doing all the training and all the rest of it. Excuse me, sorry. So epigenetics, to move on to that, is it's a related thing. So genetics, the definition of genetics would be the study of heritable changes in performance, if we're talking about sports genetics, that are the result of differences in the DNA sequence. Sorry for the formal definition. Epigenetics is essentially the same thing, heritable changes in performance that are the result of essentially changes in the way the DNA is packaged or in something called non-coding RNA. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on those. If we just think about the packaging element, so for a gene to have any effect on your VO2 max, that gene has to be expressed. You've got about 21,000 genes in all of your cells, but you don't express all of them in all of your cells. You know, you express genes that are important for being lungs in your lung cells, or important for being a heart in your heart cells, or a brain in your neurons, and so on. So it's different subsets. So they have to be expressed. And equally, in muscle cells, there are a set of genes that are being expressed. But actually, how those are packaged influences how easy it is to express them and at what level they can be expressed. And that could influence the amount of muscle you've got, or the amount of aerobic muscle that you've got, you know, type 1 or type 2 fibers that you have in your muscle. So epigenetics is studying this packaging and things related to this packaging.
Okay.
So if I can just say one more thing about that. The one of the major differences between them, if you think about it, is genetics comes from your parents. There's nothing you can do about it. You've got what you've got. You just get on with it.
Yeah.
The message in epigenetics is a little bit more positive. So whilst it's still heritable between cells as they develop, it's also possible to change it over the short term. So studies have shown that a single bout of exercise can change the DNA packaging. So even although we might be looking at how epigenetics relates to sporting performance, ultimately where we'd like to end up is being able to say, well, your DNA packaging is not quite right for you to be an elite athlete, but if you do these things here, you'll be able to change that. I mean, that's a long way off, but that's the kind of thing we'd like to be able to do.
Wow. And how, long way off, but how easy then for your research, then you're looking into primarily how to do that, how to build up a vision of I guess of DNA and how it can be manipulated. Is that where your kind of your interest lies?
No, so certainly not in the short term. So my feeling is that all this research matters. Because it can ultimately could improve public health.
Right.
So if you think about it, elite athletes place an enormous stress on their organs, or physiological systems. If they're an endurance runner, they're putting a huge stress on their muscles and on their heart and on their lungs. So that allows us then to see subtle differences in the way those organs are working that are related to their genetics.
Right.
Now, there's another group within the population that are also putting a huge stress on those organs, and those are people who are ill effectively at the other end of the distribution.
Okay.
And you can see differences in the way their organs are working based on genetics in those people as well. But what I see the value, or where I see the value of this research, is in using athletes to understand people who've got disease better and potentially improve their quality of life and improve their treatments.
Okay, because we spoke to Hugh Montgomery in at UCL recently, and he's talking about some similar research. He's talking, I think, about monitoring.
I think I've got a paper with Hugh actually.
And he was talking about guys at altitude, and obviously looking at their bodies in light of the lack of oxygen, how they reacted. Could help those who are terminally ill, who are also struggling with a similar sort of symptoms in terms of oxygen debt, I think, and various other things.
I mean, that's completely consistent. I think the two of us would wholeheartedly agree on that's the real value of doing this kind of research is what you can do with the information rather than the information itself.
To shed some light on how I kind of got in touch with it, I was thinking about kind of genetic doping, which is originally what I was thinking, and I know it's an article you'd written a while back in 2006. Is there people trying to kind of almost map elite athletes' genetic code in an effort to come up with ways of I don't know, doping genes or looking at how these epigenetic effects can improve athletes' out there? Do you think that's happening?
There's nobody doing it openly,
Yeah.
but I wouldn't be remotely surprised if there were people doing that.
Yeah.
I think ultimately, let me put it this way. There was a company called, I think it's called Repoxygen, who were making, along the same lines of health that we've just talked about, they were making a recombinant version of EPO, or sorry, a gene therapy version of EPO for people who were struggling with anemia. And it was at the stage of being tested in mouse models. And if I remember the story correctly, they had actually stopped working on it because it wasn't working. And then it came to light a few years later when there was a, I think it was a German coach, I might have that wrong, who was being tried over, I think it was doping with his athletes. I'm not totally certain on that part of the story, but it came to light during the trial that he had emailed this company and tried to get hold of their the things they were their gene therapy tool as it was off the shelf, even though it wasn't properly working.
Wow.
And the presumption is that he was going to try and give it to his athletes.
Wow.
My guess is that there are probably athletes who have tried gene therapy, although I doubt if it's worked yet. And
Yeah.
the reason I say that is if you go onto YouTube and or Google and search for biohackers and something called CRISPR, which is a way of editing DNA, there are people who have videoed themselves injecting with things that potentially could modify their genome,
Wow.
and they've stuck it on the internet for everyone else to watch.
So
I'd be surprised if some athletes haven't tried that.
wow. So that is the it's I guess like any normal doper would use. They'd inject EPO. They're injecting something that's going to na change the genetic code, which makes the production of EPO more likely. Is that kind of the a brief.
Yeah, so if you'd more EPO, your body would produce more red blood cells.
Right,
So
okay.
there are different ways you could do that. There's actually a famous Finnish cross-country skier called, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong now, called Iiro
Yeah.
Mäntyranta, who he had a natural genetic variant in his EPO receptor, so that his body effectively thought there was lots of EPO all the time.
Right.
But that was completely natural. He wasn't doping in any way.
Yeah.
He had a far higher hematocrit than was normal for everyone else, and he won lots of medals.
Wow. Okay, it sounds like an impossible thing to then to. I guess whenever there's money in something, there'll always be ways that people are looking to circumvent rules to make money or gain notoriety. So I think, I guess, with changing technology, there's always going to be ways that people are trying to push the boundaries, I guess.
Yeah, and actually, I'd go a bit further on gene doping and gene therapy. Now, again, that's not my area of research, but my feeling is that gene doping is just gene therapy for people who don't need it,
Right.
and gene therapy will work because the societal drive to get it to work for people who have health problems is huge. Of course, if you think about the difference between the idea with gene therapy, if it works properly in the way we envisage it, somebody would be able to get a treatment once in their life, rather than having to inject themselves potentially multiple times per day
Right.
to have a healthy lifestyle. So, of course, we will try and get this to work, and I think ultimately it will work. Once it works, as you've just said, there will be people who will use it for things that they shouldn't.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think it is something that sport will just have to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so in terms of what you're looking at, what's your current research project? What are you looking at the moment that might be interesting for us to hear about?
So I've got different things going on. I mean, I've got some Daily Mile stuff. Looking at a variety of things in there. One of the things we're interested in is the effect of the Daily Mile on teachers
Right.
as well, because it's not just the kids who go outside. In terms of the genetics and epigenetics, So in genetics, I'm involved in a project actually being run out of Stanford University. We are interested in recruiting people who have a very high VO2 max. So we glossed over this earlier, but when you're looking at the genetics of something, what you want is something very clean, that's easy to measure. So although if you're interested in the genetics of performance, the obvious thing to work on is people who win medals. Actually, there's lots of different ways to win medals. You might, if you think of, say, the 10,000 meters, you might have an incredible sort of pace throughout the entire race, or maybe you're a bit slower for most of the race and you've got an amazing sprint finish. Maybe you've got a great running economy. There's all sorts of slightly different things. So we've tried to go for a slightly cleaner phenotype, and we're interested in people with very extreme VO2 max. So we're interested in getting DNA and a short questionnaire from males who've got, at any stage in their life, have had a VO2 max measured at over 75 mils per kilogram per minute, or females who at any stage in their life have had a VO2 max of 63 mils per kilogram per minute. And we are trying to look at the genetic, look for genetic changes in those people compared to people who don't have those extreme phenotypes, to see if we can develop the genetics of elite performance there. In terms of the, sorry, do you want to ask a question or?
No, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, in terms of the epigenetics, I've got a student who's working with a rugby club, looking at something called microRNAs, which are very small microRNAs, like the name suggests. And we have samples from before and after pre-season training. So we are trying to see if some of those microRNAs can help us predict who had the biggest responses to pre-season training. So a variety of different projects there
Yeah, it's
that I'm
all
involved
incredibly
in.
interesting stuff. Like for us, just as runners, we come up with a training plan that we think probably is based on, what other people have done in the past and has worked, and we go ahead and we just keep bashing our heads against the wall with the same things. But the amount of we never really think about how our body's really responding to these various stimuluses and how we could even monitor those, and also we never think that. Kind of are as we all think of ourselves as beacons of health, I guess, and we never really think how we could our lives could affect those, or how perhaps they have things in common with those who are at the very bottom of the scale and who are dying essentially, and how our physiology could be a benefit to how they survive and
Yeah, no,
how.
absolutely, absolutely, and I think you've touched on something in there that I see happening a lot, where runners see somebody else doing something and think, well, that must be the key, I'll do that. But actually, because of the underlying genetics, actually the right thing for each individual to do could be a different thing. You know, if somebody has a slight genetic predisposition to a certain type of injury, maybe training twice a day is not for them. And actually, if they want to manage themselves, they've really got to pay attention to their own bodies and what works for them and what doesn't work for them. It won't be the same things for everyone.
And it's hard. There's lots of different companies now come out offering sort of genetic tests and stuff and that sort of thing. Is the science there yet? Are we able to look at our DNA and suggest sort of types of training that might work for us, or is that something that's very difficult to do and it's something we should be looking at? I don't know, trial and error and using ourselves as almost a test.
So I'm going to be careful here. I would say that doing some of those genetic tests with the companies is a lot of fun. But personally, I would always be trying to do a bit of trial and error and think about things myself and listen to myself. I mean, to what I think it's important to remember is that our best estimate of how many genes are involved in this, in something like sport and performance, comes from height. There are estimated to be about 1,000 genes which influence your height, each with a small effect. If you think about it, 100% divided by 1,000 means that each one is 0.1% of the differences between us. So they're all very small effects. But if we estimate that there are probably about 1,000 genes involved in sporting performance, then we're going to need to know about the majority of them to be able to make predictions about how people should be training. And at the moment, we don't know that information.
Okay. Interesting. And I just realized I shouldn't keep you too much longer as we're eating into your working day. So I've got three quick fire questions just to ask you to finish off with. And I haven't asked much about your own running. Obviously, you're keen to help with the Daily Mile, but are you much for running yourself?
Not anymore. I used to be. I had knee surgery about a year ago, which I'd had a problem with my knee for a number of years before that. So I haven't got too much back into running since then. I'd play a lot of sport, play a lot of squash and football.
Yeah.
But I guess if I could be running anywhere at the moment, I can see from my office window, I can see Damietta and the Ochil Hills in the sunshine and the blue sky, and it would be quite nice to be running up there just now.
Lovely.
So.
With a knee that works.
Yeah, which it does work now, so
Good.
I can do these kind of things.
Yeah. And second question is, can you recommend our listeners something? Can be anything from podcast, book, film, or to an experience or something they should try in their training. It's a broad remit.
Sorry. I've my mind's gone blank on that one. I think if I was if I was going to recommend anything to them, it would be that point that I almost made before about thinking of personalizing your training and thinking of what works for you as an individual rather than just what you've seen work for Mo Farah or somebody else
Yeah.
on the television.
So our last question, what in your opinion is the greatest single endurance performance of all time? So it can be a running performance or just a feat of endurance.
So, I mean, there are lots of great feats of endurance and performance and different races that people do, but the one that always sticks in my mind is a baby Bekele, again I probably pronounced that wrong, in Rome in 1960, winning the marathon with no shoes on. I
Yeah,
always think that's
incredible.
just quite incredible.
Yeah, really great. And there is a really good book about him actually. They're called The Barefoot Runner. Really good
yeah
book
yeah
about his life.
that's
So
right yeah
that's one recommendation. Yeah, great. That's the first time he's been mentioned, which is a good one. Yeah, I went to Addis Ababa for a training trip, and I went down to the big stadium in the middle of town, and there was all these big, beautiful paintings of AB Bekele on the outside. It was
Oh
pretty amazing.
yeah.
Great guy. Excellent.
Yeah,
Well, thanks.
I've never been, but I've heard about that kind
Oh,
of
it's
stuff.
great space. But thanks very much for your time, Colin. We'll put a link to the Daily Mail. Is there somewhere people can go to find out more information if they want to start their own project in a school, or is it best to just look online?
It's well, the place to go is online. I mean, you'll find stuff on Stirling University website if you search for Daily Mile, or on the Daily Mile Foundation website itself. If you put those into Google, they'll come up quickly.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Colin. Enjoy the rest of your day, and fingers crossed the Daily Mile goes from strength to strength.
Brilliant. Nice to chat to you. Thank you
Cheers,
very
Colin.
much.
Bye bye.